Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus Season 27, Episode 9. Coming up on this show, we've got Nevada's reptilian handlers, the terror on the Nullarbor, and the curse of the Marquis de Sade. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
You were telling me today about the Marquis de Sade because for whatever reason, I've seen him fictionalized in, you know, comedies and, you know, those sorts of, you know, television shows. But you were pointing out that this man was horrible. He was absolutely a terrible human being.
Oh, he was truly evil. Some of the things that he did to young women and young men and everyone else in between are really, really disgusting and horrible.
Because you were telling me that this is where the term sadist comes from.
Yeah, sadism. That's how it entered our lexicon because of this guy. And he's famous for this scroll that he penned when he was imprisoned in the Bastille.
Ah.
The famous prison in Paris in, what was it, 1987? I think he was locked up in 1987.
It's a bit recent.
He's writing his 80s manuscripts.
How did you come across this?
This new book from Joel Warner, The Curse of the Marquis de Sade. It's just such an epic book. He essentially writes three stories. He writes the story of the history of the Marquis de Sade. And Marquis is just like a French title.
It's an aristocracy title.
Yeah, it's a title of aristocracy. And he details the life of this man, which is a story I don't think I can even follow on the show because
it's just so horrible.
He's like slicing up prostitutes and torturing people. And just, it's really horrible. He's doing like scat porn in the 1700s. It's gross.
Ah.
But he follows this story because he's still obviously an interesting character from history. But this is woven in with this manuscript that he wrote, which was called 120 Days of Sodom, and he secretly penned it on this scroll and hid it in his cell in the Bastille. And Warner follows the ownership of this scroll throughout history and essentially details how everyone that's come to own it has suffered a horrible fate, has suffered some kind of awful turn of events or awful turn of fortune. And he weaves this in with a third story, which is essentially the story of the biggest Ponzi scheme in France's history, like rivaling
really?
Bernie Madoff. And it essentially culminates in this, here's the thing, the trial still hasn't gone through yet. The guy that's accused of this greatest Ponzi scheme in France still hasn't faced trial. There's doubts as to whether it'll ever see trial. And he accuses the French government in a kind of conspiracy to take him down. And he had this empire where he was basically selling rare books and rare letters and manuscripts, became incredibly wealthy, this guy.
Where was he getting them?
Well, he would buy them. He was a dealer.
Right.
He would have a network of dealers and he would buy rare books and manuscripts. Like, you know, famously he had a letter from Einstein that detailed his first musings on the theory of relativity. And I think he bought it for like 12 million euros or something.
Mm-hmm.
He would buy things like that, like really rare letters. And he would essentially give you an opportunity to buy shares in the letter. And this was an ingenious move because, you know, for centuries, people had obviously traded in rare books and manuscripts, especially in France. France is known for being the bibliography.
I had no idea you could get shares in documents.
Well, no one had thought about it before this guy. And this guy, who I don't have his French, weird French name in front of me, but I'll get to it later. But he figured out this way where he offered shares in Einstein's letter, for example. So you'd buy like a 50 grand share, and he would divide this up over 400 people. So you would own a part of Einstein's letter.
And I'm assuming the idea is that the document would appreciate with age.
Well, this is part of what they did and why it eventually drew eyes from French prosecutors is he would essentially sell you the share to a manuscript or an old book or a letter or something. And then after 5 years, they would offer to buy it back off you, this company that he ran, usually with an appreciation of 40%, sorry.
Wow,
so
that's
you
pretty
high. You would make 40% over, 5 years on these investments. And the French government took him down, but it still hasn't seen trial. And there's basically two camps. There's one camp that says, oh no, this was a Ponzi. Although he was selling real things. There wasn't some kind of ephemeral nothing behind his sale. They're real things that people own. So there's one camp that says it's a Ponzi scheme, but the other camp is saying, no, the French government took him down because he wouldn't give him the Marquis de Sade's scroll.
Or is it also that if this is a cursed scroll, that it befell him because of the curse?
Well, he eventually acquired the scroll for a massive fortune, which is this huge story. And I think it was like 3 or 4 months after he acquired the scroll, that's when the French government cracked down on him and he lost this billion-dollar empire.
Interesting. Oh, I'm looking forward to getting into that.
Yeah, there's multiple cases of this, of whoever gets hold of this scroll from Marquis de Sade ends up getting shafted.
In light of what we talk about with psychometry and, you know, energy going into objects and items, I'm beginning to speculate. I'm not saying I totally believe in it, but I'm beginning to speculate that if things like thought forms and tulpas and psychometry actually exists, if you are such a horrible, evil person and you're, you know, committing these atrocities and these terrible acts, that you could somehow imbue that into something. I mean, what are spells? You know what I mean? The idea with spells is that, or incantations, is that they're magical in a way. You could do it in a negative form. So I wouldn't be surprised if a curse could be imbued into a document.
Well, coming up in my segment, I'm going to reveal some people who have worked on translations over the last 100 years.
And from French.
Yeah, well, it's from French, obviously. And many of them will reveal, after they've worked on this translation, some of them even say it's like when you read this manuscript, the manuscript reads you.
Oh, wow.
One guy in particular said, sometimes it feels like a work of literature has agency. And he said he actually felt exhausted and drained in this strange way after reading this manuscript and trying to do the translation. Multiple people have said this over the years.
Well, that's why I say it, because we always complain about when we find a really incredible story. It's in French. It's because no one's willing to translate it, because it's too terrifying The moment they start rewriting it.
What have you found today?
Well, I'm going to continue with the story of what happened to Doug Amos and his son, Stephen, that I was describing on the last show. How, you know, they had these multitude of strange encounters of this weird light that was filling their backyard, and they were unable to recall what had taken place. They knew that they were freaked out. They knew that they were disturbed by it, but no one really understood until many, many, many years later. Doug, who was much older now, he reached out to Victorian UFO Action, this UFO group, and started describing his story. And of course, the investigators from this group spoke to other members of the family, and we found out ultimately in that story that Stephen had seen these pink, fleshy insectoids appear in the backyard between him and his father and then take them somewhere. And he wasn't able to pull anything else out of those memories. But a really good, you know, indicator with these stories that something is kind of not right is that there is this intrinsic fear that people have, almost like a post-traumatic stress disorder, from rather innocuous things like light, for example. Like there'll be a flash of light, you know, a car will drive past your house and there'll be a flash of light in your window. And some people that are abductees, apparently abductees, will totally flip out, have a disturbing experience. And that's exactly what happened to Uncle Sid in this story, and it connects back to the Nullarbor Plain. So I'm going to go into some of these stories, which will then follow on to other kind of details that I've found about similar abduction scenarios that have popped up, not just in Australia, but all around the world. And I also want to tell you the story of the Aboriginal guide, Sam. Now, I haven't been able to get many details out of this, but actually after what we were talking about with the land between lands and people having experiences with werewolves and not coming forward with that information, there is a story, an anecdotal story floating around out there, which many claim is true. But the argument is that werewolves were actually brought to Australia.
Really?
By European settlers, which is really unusual. And it came through things like the Hexham Heads. It actually came through rocks.
A
cursed object came to Australia with European settlers, and the Aboriginals somehow got a hold of it.
Because it would be kind of hard to hide the traditional idea of a werewolf where some sailor transforms under the full moon, kills everyone on board.
Exactly. But if it was somehow imbued into some type of object and it carried a curse with it, much like what you're going to be describing, Ben, maybe there's a possibility. I'm just saying a very small possibility that that is what has happened. So I'll come back to the story of Sam in a moment, but let's go back to Sid, who is the uncle of Stephen, who was in this home in Heidelberg, a suburban suburb of Victoria, when all of this weird activity had been taking place. And look, go back and listen to that last episode if you haven't heard it, so you get an understanding of what the story is. But ultimately, we skip forward to, if you recall, I was telling you that Stephen, for a while, was living in this room at the very back of the house, which was also the exit to the house. So anyone that wanted to go out to the backyard to hang laundry or do whatever else would have to go through this. And he finally got sick of it. So he asked his father to build like a granny flat at the back, this little, you know, self-contained unit. And they did. They built this thing. And so Stephen would go and live out in this unit. But because this room, Stephen had moved out of it, they had to start renovating it. They thought that they had an opportunity to renovate it. And the story goes that Sid was painting this room. They'd, you know, cleared this room out and they were renovating it and they were painting it. And Sid says that there was this flash, this flash of light. And when he looked out the window, he saw it pour down, like it flooded down and it kind of filled into the backyard like there was a substance to it. And this is something that was described earlier by Stephen and his father as well. They said there was like a substance to it. There was a feeling that was associated with this light. And in fact, when I've looked through some of the archives of reports from Australian researchers, there are reports out there, in fact, of something very similar being described in the state of New South Wales. There was a report about a man who was in a caravan in the state of New South Wales, actually down towards Batemans Bay. So this is on the south coast of New South Wales, you know, maybe, I don't know, what, a couple of hours drive south from Sydney. And on this particular occasion, this particular man claimed that he'd been in a caravan and he too was seeing these flashes. Like he saw these flashes and where his caravan was, it looked out towards the beach. Now he claims that on this particular evening, he saw this flash. The flash was so bright that it brought him out of his sleep and he thought, oh, maybe it's lightning. So he gets up to have a look to see what's going on, being a storm or something like that. And he says he sees a classic saucer-shaped craft hovering over the amenities block. Like over the toilet block, the shower block just there. He claims he sees this saucer-shaped craft fire a beam into the amenities block, but the beam, rather than penetrating or behaving in the fashion that you expect light to behave in from the physics that we understand, he said it flowed over the building. Like it actually engulfed the entirety of the building and flowed over it and then flashed out. It was like it was maybe scanning or doing, but it was just weird in the way that this light behaved. He continued to watch it. He said they went to another caravan that was quite close to him, fired another white beam into this caravan. It also splashed, is the term that was used. It splashed over the caravan in this white, luminous light fluid all over it, encasing it, falling over the sides, and then just disappearing once again. He then claims that he watched as there was a couple that was sitting out on the beach. Now, he was quite distant from it. He could see the beach, but he was quite distant, so he could only see two silhouettes of people because it's late at night and there's not many lights down there, but he could see that there were silhouettes of people. He then claims that this thing, as they're standing in awe on the beach, watching the same thing that he's been watching, that this thing comes over, fires the beam at these two. They get engulfed in this light, and guess what happens? When the light's gone, so are they. They're gone. Now, he's shocked by this. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Because you don't know what to do. This was the 80s that this took place. He doesn't know what to do. I mean, he doesn't know who to report it to. He's just seen something incredible. No one's going to believe him. So he goes back to bed and has a very restless evening. And he gets up in the morning and no one seems to be saying anything about it. Like, there's just nothing being reported. He starts asking around, saying, oh, you know, has anyone not come back to their camper van or come
back?
Did
they come back?
No, they never came back, right?
No, you can't have all these missing people and then nothing
just
to come of it.
It was just two people. It was just two people. No one.
So this is now a missing persons case.
But the thing is, though, is when he asked around, nobody had seen. There was no missing camper vans. There was no camper vans sitting around where people hadn't returned. No one knew anything about what he was reporting. Like, nothing. But the weird thing that came out of this story was that later on he was reading in the newspaper that an albatross or a naval aircraft that was being used in that area on that night apparently came down as a result of electrical malfunctions after encountering some weird electrical interference. And that's all that was reported in the news.
So there's no missing people?
There's no missing people. But he claims that he witnessed this thing and he went to a researcher 30 years later and described this experience.
Were they not people?
Well, that's what I wonder. I wonder, is
getting picked
was
up.
He seeing? And some of the stories I'm going to tell you as well, I've got, you know, and you've touched on some of these stories in the past, Ben, but Preston Dennett has got a YouTube channel, and he basically just puts together a collection of these different stories from people like, you know, Brad Steiger and John Keel and, you know, some of the real heavyweights in the industry describing these sorts of hitchhiker encounters where people have encountered what clearly are extraterrestrials because there's UFOs attached to it. But they're human-looking ETs. Like, they're human-looking, but they seem to vanish and disappear, much in the classic phantom hitchhiker kind of thing. And so many of these stories that you go into, you find that it's like these alien hitchhikers are basically like calling people down, like waving people down to get a lift in the car so that they can get taken to where the UFO will pick them up and they just dematerialize. So very similar to that report from Australia in the 1980s.
Yeah, the one that I remember was the guy that convinced two women to give him a lift, even though they were moving across country and the entire back of their car was just full of all their stuff.
Yeah.
So there was literally no free spots in the car, and he somehow convinces them that they can give him a lift, and he sits on the lap of the passenger, the woman in the passenger seat.
That's right, yes.
And after a while, after about an hour of driving, she suddenly realizes, this is really weird, and you don't weigh anything, sir. And he's like, she looks down and he's hovering an inch above her lap.
That's right. And I recall in that particular story, the driver, I think after all this took place, her house was besieged by poltergeist activity as well after this took place. But she takes her hand and she puts her hand in between her friend's lap and this guy. And she's like, she could run her hand through
there.
Yeah,
that's right.
It was an inch. And I think with that one, he got them to she got through to Anchorage, I believe. And there was a UFO waiting. And he just got out of the car and off he went to the UFO and flew away. I'll link to those in the show notes so you can actually check out his channel directly, because he does reference one of his most recent books that goes into some of these, you know, really unusual reports.
And there was that hitchhiker in Ukraine who... Didn't he paralyze the guy's daughter and then start speaking into some weird alien black box?
Yes, I recall that one. It was because that was on Crimea. Again, though, this weird element of it being in a reasonably remote, isolated location. It was along the Crimean coastline. And you're right, they see this extremely tall man and they pull over and he's wearing this one-piece kind of suit. It's always with these reports, they're wearing these weird one-piece, slightly glowing suits.
She was begging her father to give him a lift.
Yeah, because he was hot. Apparently, he was just like smoking hot. He was like a space Fabio.
And then he basically knocked her out and then just got out of the car and started taking plant samples.
That's
in front
right.
of him. And then he disappeared in a beam of light.
He knocked her out because he got into the back of the car. And he didn't say anything. And they asked, you know, like, where do you want to go? And he kind of pointed to the highway. And when he did so, he was holding this black cube and he was mumbling what appeared to be a foreign language in the back. And the father was getting really freaked out because obviously he was worried about his daughter. And at the last moment, he took that cube and he shoved it into the daughter's back. Like he pulled her hair back and shoved it into her back. And that's when they became paralyzed and he was able to talk into this thing to use it to maybe summon a UFO.
And he did summon a UFO or something because he disappeared in a beam of light. And then I remember the girl said that after this incident, she was fine, but her eyes had changed color. And I specifically remember telling this story and then you going, oh, bullshit.
No, because his eyes kept on reverting to black, I think. It was like this.
No, her eyes changed color.
Oh, her eyes changed color.
Her eyes had been brown since birth and were now green in color. And I remember you going, that is a crock of shit. And now you're doing these stories on the show.
You're trying to bring me down, Ben. Like, no. Look, I'm just using these as examples because there's a multitude of these that are happening globally and they seem to have these commonalities in them. And as much as these individual stories are always, you know, fun and exciting, there's just not enough in these individual stories. But when you start finding the commonalities between them, this is why you've got the great researchers over the years that have done this. You go, what is this pattern that's going on and why are they doing this? And
so
Australia,
what is the pattern?
Well, the pattern appears to be is that they are a group of human-looking extraterrestrials that seem to follow the same modus operandi of, especially when it comes to hitchhikers, they wave people down, they get in the car, they're usually wearing a strange one-piece suit. In fact, Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, who's appeared on the show a couple of times, she's really great in the way that she kind of has acted as a liaison with the American Indian community and different tribes to bring their stories forward. And this is something that Preston reported on because she got stories of a guy that had seen, you know, people being waved down by, like, they didn't look like the normal American Indians that are in that region, for example. There's one guy that was driving along, and he sees this guy dressed, again, in this weird kind of suit. He's like, this is odd. And he pulls over and he says, oh, do you want to get into the car? And he's like, doesn't say anything. He just gets into the car and points, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it follows this. So again, you've got a different culture, but they're reporting the same elements that aren't out there, right? This stuff isn't out there because it's contained. And at the time, I think with this particular American Indian, he thought that the guy was a Navajo, because he said normally Navajo are more quiet and reserved. And that's why he thought he was a Navajo until this UFO flew over the top of him and literally beamed him out of the car.
Yeah.
You know, so this is, but why? Why is this happening? Why are they doing this kind of stuff?
Why do you need a lift to get picked up by a UFO?
Well, some of them, one of the repeating and recurring themes in these stories is that a lot of people, like there was one guy that was in the 1960s or 1970s, but he was part of a band. And this weird man approached them as they were packing up their van. And he says, oh, can I get a lift? And essentially, he looks odd. Like, he's extremely tall. They're always extremely tall, wearing these weird clothing that look like coveralls. And he's like, oh, yeah, I guess so. But we've got, you know, all of our band equipment, so it's going to be a little bit, you know, squashed in there. He's like, oh, no, it's fine. It's okay. And as soon as, it's like the old, like, folkloric legends of having to invite someone in.
Yeah.
It's like, once you invite them into the car, the recurring theme that comes up in these reports is that people feel like they are under the control of the person that's in the vehicle. And they do. Like, there was one, I think, where they...
So what happened with the band?
Well, with the band is that, like many of these other stories, normally you take the highway, right? This is like, normally you take the fastest route you can to get somewhere, but they felt compelled to drive down a different road. Like, for whatever reason, and it's always a remote, isolated road. And guess what happens? They drive down this remote, isolated road. They come to a saucer sitting in the middle of the field or in the middle of the road. They get out of the car. They feel like they're compelled to get out. Guess what gets them out of the car?
Isn't that Grays in that encounter?
Grays! Yeah, Grays get them out of the car. They get taken aboard a saucer. They get taken up. Once they're on board the saucer, they get put onto chrome tables. They have samples taken. And the whole time, they're like, oh, this is cool. Oh, it's okay. Like, they're under the influence of something until they're then separated and taken into separate rooms and have blood samples taken. And they're told, oh, this is for humanity's good. And they're kicked back out and they wake up again inside the vehicle. But the following morning, it's like 11 hours have passed. And in fact, I think in that particular story, two of them were inside the vehicle and one of them was outside lying on the ground. You know, this stuff is just is extremely strange, but it feels like it's got this element of you have to give them permission. And once you give them permission, then you're free game. Like, they'll do whatever they want to you. You know, one really great story that was similar to that is that there was a guy driving along in a Volkswagen Beetle. And again, this is the 1960s, 1970s. He's driving along an isolated remote road. He sees these extremely tall people standing on the side of the road. He said they're 9 feet, 10 feet tall, abnormally large. And he pulls over. And as he pulls over, he's talking to them. And it was a man and a woman. And they're kind of just like, oh. He said, are you waiting for someone? I'm like, yes, we've been waiting for you. And
is this the one on the side of the mountain?
I can't recall if it's on the side of the mountain, but what happens is another car pulls past and the car says to him, are you okay? And they can't see them.
Yeah, I told this one on Dennett's story.
And remember how they shrank?
Yeah.
Like, they're like, oh, don't worry about the size. They shrank to get into the car.
Yeah.
They drive along. And then when they get out, they go back to their normal size. So these sorts of reports, though, it's like, well, why? Why is this happening? Well, we might get some insight into what's happening here. Because when we go back to the story of Sid, the reason why when Sid, you know, we're going all the way back to this story where Sid was standing in this back room and he's painting the room and there's this flash of light. And when he has the flash of light, which is obviously coming through from outside, that if you recall, the neighbor said they couldn't see it. And yet, so these family members are all seeing and it's all very defined. The light is not, like, it's contained within a certain area. It's this odd physics occurring once again. And as he said, he sees the flash of light, he can feel it. He actually can feel it all around him. It has a physical substance to it and something rattles him and he feels a danger that he can't consciously compute, but he knows that he's felt this danger before and he ends up becoming extremely distressed by this light and he feels under threat from this. And he's like trying to rationalize it at the same time is, oh, it must be a helicopter. It must be. But this was the late 1980s in Australia. Apparently, the type of lights that were used by modern helicopters that have like a million candle power or something, which is what would be equivalent to generate this kind of light, didn't exist in the 1980s, or it certainly weren't available in Australia in the 1980s. That was the 1990s that kind of stuff came along. So for this, it's like it wasn't a helicopter. And why would a helicopter fire this light over your house? You didn't hear any noise. But he couldn't work it out. Now, if you recall, the wife in that report, Doug's wife, she was in a trance and she's talking, like looking at the wall, even though she's like, oh, this was a good TV show. And she finally comes out. Sid goes also running into the living room and he sees her also in this trance. And the reason why all these memories start coming back is that he said that he'd been trying astral travel and he'd been getting these spontaneous sensations that had been occurring during these events. Like, this is stuff that he's kind of messed with. And it's funny how you hear, you know, someone who seemingly has been involved with some element of abduction also trying out things like astral travel. It's like there's this weird connection between people when they seem to have these encounters. And whether or not it's because they start experimenting with this stuff because of their encounters, or if they've been doing the encounter or they've been doing the experiments and that brings about the attention of these things, I don't know. But in this particular case, it really does feel like it's the family. The entire family have been selected by these beings for whatever purpose. But he says just before all of this activity had been taking place, he had been traveling alone along the Nullarbor Plain in Western Australia. And this Nullarbor Plain is a highly, highly remote location. There's just nothing out there for hundreds of miles.
Like when you cross it, you've got to make sure you've got tons of water, spare fuel.
Enough food, because if you break down, you potentially could be in a lot of trouble out there. Not so much these days, but certainly back then. But even these days, it's still not an easy thing to do. But as he's driving along, he claims that a sudden storm comes up. It's got a very Missing 411 kind of feel. And when this storm comes up and there's lightning all around, he passes through this bank of fog. And as he passes, and this is what's reported also in those hitchhiking encounters, Ben, in a couple of reports, is that people suddenly say that they'll drive through a bank of fog, like this fog that appears, and it's this recurring kind of theme, like it's a camouflage or something to cover up their deeds. But as he drives through, he says he can see on the right-hand side, it's only on the right-hand side, all of these bright lights out in the paddocks that are kind of to the distance. And he says they start coming towards him, like they're moving much closer to him. And there's nothing for miles and miles and miles. And he says there must be thousands of these bright lights, just thousands.
Min-min.
They're like min-min, but they were following along with him. It's almost like they were influencing him or doing something. Now, he was freaked out, right? This caused him to have a reaction. He had a visceral reaction to seeing this kind of stuff. And out there, it's hard to know distances, but these things were only, maybe 100 meters away, maybe 200 meters away. It wasn't far. And then they're gone. But for whatever reason, he got to Adelaide. That very night, he felt compelled to turn around and go back the very direction he had come.
Why?
I don't know. He just said he felt compelled to do it. And he did.
That's a long drive.
It's an extremely long
drive. It's a very remote, and compelling.
For him to suddenly go, he's like, oh, well, I had work that I could still do. And like, so he was driving, like he was moving from Western Australia to Adelaide. And all of a sudden, after he sees all these lights, he's like, oh, that very night, I'd better turn around and go back.
That's like an 8-hour drive.
More. And he does. And he says by the time they get to the morning, he finds that where all those fields were, right, where he thought that they were houses because there was just so many of them and he thought he was going through a town, nothing there, like nothing there at all. And then, of course, later on, he has this experience, like this fear that comes up. Now, from the research that I did, perhaps, he may have done a regression later on, but I couldn't find any further details about what he had gone into.
So nothing happens to him. He drives for 8 hours back into the middle of nowhere and nothing happens, and he drives home.
But then later on, only a few months later, this is where he ends up, in his brother's place, painting, and this flash of light comes through. Right. And then all of a sudden, all the family members are having encounters as well. So you could go, okay, well, maybe this is an isolated kind of thing. And, on the last show, I was talking about Pine Gap, and there is some argument that some of this stuff, and this kind of ties in with like the MyLabs concept, the idea that there's military abductions going on, that there's some type of experiment that's being conducted and there's fake abductions taking place. And for whatever purpose, it's difficult to know, but it's being done under the guise of being extraterrestrials, because then the government can get away with whatever they want with impunity. Well, there's a researcher by the name of William Buckley. And William Buckley, if you recall the Knowles encounter, so the Knowles Knowles encounter happened back in 1988. That was Faye Knowles and her adult sons, Patrick and Sean, and Wayne as well. I'll link to this in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can read the full story. It's a very well-known case. Like, it's an exceptionally well-known case because in that particular story, they were driving along this Nullarbor Plain in a nutshell. And as they're driving along this very same location, obviously the Nullarbor Plain is very huge, but it's the same kind of region. As they're driving along, they see this light in the distance. And, you know, they thought maybe it was the sun coming up, but it wasn't. It was still so dark. But essentially, this light came down upon their vehicle, filled their vehicle with some type of gas. It essentially gassed them with this dark, sooty kind of gas. And they said it was like a sponge, like a magnetic sponge, had stuck to their roof and lifted their car off the road, if
that's
you recall.
Right. Yeah.
It lifted their car off the road. They're engulfed in this grey mist, again, with the hitchhikers and the fog and the mist going on. And this force, it blew out one of their tyres and the electricals are going crazy and their windows are down. And this stuff stinks that's coming into their car as well, this smell that's coming through. And ultimately, they get dumped back down on the road. And when they get dumped back down the road, they get out of the car and they go and hide behind a tree. And this light continues to hover around, almost like it's looking for them. Eventually, the light disappears and they see another vehicle and they get the hell out of there and end up in a local town. And they report what they'd seen. And apparently, you know, the Royal Australian Air Force was interested in what had taken place. There was other elements here that kind of have a apparently Men in Black feel, but I won't go into that. But going back to William Buckley has, he claims, and he has, you know, cites no source for this, so I don't know where he's gotten this from, but he suggests that this wasn't an actual UFO abduction at all. It's the weirder concept that this was an attack by a secret government organization using a helicopter and a very powerful technologically advanced electromagnet to lift the vehicle up. He said that the attack on the Knowles family was orchestrated and carried out by a well-resourced paramilitary organization operating in the background of Australia.
What?
It used a sophisticated helicopter with specialized lifting equipment. The Knowles' involvement was purely accidental. They were not the intended target, and they were attacked only because they resembled the real target group who were also traveling on the same road that night.
So who was the real target group? Like someone involved in the exercise?
Yes.
Some military target.
Some target that was being conducted. So
part of the training exercise.
They got it wrong. Like, they made a mistake. And then when you look at what I was talking about, how I referenced Pine Gap and all the weird stuff that's going on there and the allegations of the being a testing ground for advanced aircraft, I probably wouldn't be surprised if there was some secret group that was conducting these tests in the Australian outback, because there is just nothing there. And Buckley says that, look, this paramilitary group are of importance in the assassination attempt or training for assassination attempts. They're shrouded in secrecy and there's cover-ups here that because nobody wants the truth to be revealed. So, you know, who knows exactly what that is, but also I'll link to that so you can, you know, read more about that.
And this paramilitary group somehow has the ability to telepathically compel this man to drive from Adelaide back out to the Australian outback.
Well, possibly. I mean, this is what's possibly happening, is this whole, a lot of this stuff some type of weird extension of MK Ultra, some type of mind control experiment? Is it some type of biological weapons testing? Is it, you know, something beyond the comprehension of what we would think our governments are capable of? I really wouldn't be surprised. We know that governments do these sorts of things, maybe not to this level, but we do know that they surreptitiously conduct experiments upon their own citizens. It's abhorrent, it's wrong, but we know that it's happened. There's enough evidence out there to show that it absolutely does. And of course, you have that figure coming out of you know, the Pine Gap story with TRW, you know, the Edward Snowden character, reporting that the CIA was doing all kinds of things like interfering in Australian elections and overturning the Australian government. So it wouldn't be, I wouldn't put it past them that they would do this kind of stuff. But then, of course, you know, maybe it's a mixture of things. Maybe it is extraterrestrials as well. I don't know what to make of it. And it reminded me actually of a story that I was reading about only recently. And there's not a lot of details in this, but this was actually picked up by a Western Australia research organization. And it allegedly happened back on the 4th of February in 1992. This occurred in Two Rocks at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And it relates to the story of Ron. Now, Ron obviously is a pseudonym, this name that's provided. So, but it ties in with the theme of what I've been describing, right? So Ron was awoken by this extremely bright, white, brilliant flash. Like it was this bright flash that happened that seemingly teleported him outside of his house. He said he found himself standing in his pajamas in a random car park somewhere. He wasn't familiar with where the car park was, but he felt like he hadn't gone far. But he's standing in this car park trying to understand what the hell's happening. Obviously, it would be extremely confusing. And he says, as he looks around, there's like 30 other people stiffly erect in a dull or altered state of consciousness. And a man in a white coat, different from the others, comes around and imparts a telepathic message to him. He says, you have been chosen, right?
It's not an alien-looking man. This is a human man.
It's a human.
What's he wearing?
In a white coat. Like a scientist, like a lab coat, right? And he imparts a telepathic message. And after he's told, you have been chosen, Ron then finds himself teleported once again inside a community hall. Like he knew where this community hall was, and it was used for basketball and other sporting activities. And he said, this is where there were other humanoids, but they weren't human. Like they were humanoids. They were extraterrestrial.
Wait, this isn't an Australian story.
Yeah, this is Two Rocks in Western Australia.
Because this is word for word that the guy that claimed he was, I can't remember his name, but he was abducted in the United States, a state somewhere, and he came to in like an auditorium, like
really?
A basketball stadium. And he claims that they were trained for some kind of counterterrorism.
Oh, I'm just hang on.
But he claims that it was reptilians that were training him.
So he doesn't mention reptilian. It is strange though that there are those parallels.
There's a bunch of silly stories like that. I don't put too much stock in them.
I just don't know what to think of that. Well, basically with this particular story, right? And the reason why I mentioned it is because of the element of the lab coat, right? And the idea of experiments being conducted. But also this has a family kind of feel to it because he says when he's approached by these humanoids, they're about 4 feet tall, right? He doesn't give any other details. He doesn't describe if they're grays. They're just like, you know, these weird 4 feet tall humanoids. They come up to him and they give him, listen to this, how very Australian. They give him a cricket bat, 3 wickets and a cricket ball. Like why would you do that?
To
why
play
would you,
cricket,
why would
obviously.
You give him a cricket bat?
To play cricket.
But you'd use a cricket. Like if you're Australian, you know that a cricket bat is great for taking Gray's heads off. Like
that's
why
true.
Would you give him a weapon? Well, anyway, he's obviously under the influence of something. But as soon as they give him the cricket bat, he suddenly recalls an abduction experience he had when he was 7 years old.
What?
Right? And he's like, is the memories coming back. He's finally gone from being like confused to now being truly terrified. And he said, as he's terrified, guess what's happening? There's another 4 foot tall freak that's kind of next to him going, draining the emotions out of him.
Oh, right.
As he's freaking out and panicking.
Getting that sweet, sweet trauma juice.
Yeah, this little 4 foot freak is like draining the energy.
Did he have a straw?
Well, no, that's not described, but I wouldn't be surprised. So he panics, right? And he runs for the hall's entrance. And just as he, like there's like a bar, you know, there's bars for those big kind of doors. He hits the bar. And as soon as he hits the bar, again, another sudden flash, this sensation of falling. And he finds himself spread-eagled back on his bed.
Was he abducted as a child while playing outback cricket or something?
I don't know.
And giving him the cricket bat
triggered
the memory.
I don't know what to make of this, right? So he has these memories come back, but he finds himself on his bed and he thinks that, I mean, I'm assuming he would think that this is probably just a really vivid and bad dream. That is, of course, like I said, this happened on the 4th of February in 1992. We skip forward to the 4th of March. In 1992, again, it's 2:15 a.m., Ron wakes up to see his son, who was age 10, in a weird half-sitting position being floated past his bedroom door. Guiding this boy was a misty alien form, like this 4 foot, but in a misty kind of like out of phase kind of form. Now, Ron jumps out of bed. It doesn't say whether or not he grabs a cricket bat, but that's what I'd be doing. And he starts shouting at this alien as it was pulling his son essentially through the house. What do you think happens? Sudden flash, Ron finds himself back in his bed. Now, he gets up in the morning and where there's some validation, but also, you know, it's a fearful thing that happens for Ron, is that his son, without any prompting, says, oh, Dad, I had a really bad nightmare last night. And, you know, obviously, Ron's like, okay, this isn't a nightmare. My son recalled this. But this was the story that I wanted to mention to you, Ben, that at breakfast, the son had a coughing fit. Like, he had this terrible coughing fit. And when he was coughing, he coughed up a piece of metal about a centimetre long, like half an inch long. Mm. Now, this metal was handed over to an Australian researcher, an Australian UFO researcher, and was taken to Curtin University. Now, it was found that the metal was a very unusual, I've got to highlight that, a very unusual combination on nickel, silver, zinc, copper, cobalt, and another unknown metal. Now, the initial analysis indicated that the artifact was actually of an unknown source. Right? That's what was first reported. But guess what happened? Later on, the lab issued a retraction and said, oh no, it's from possibly a Swedish instrument of some kind.
Bloody Swedes.
Well, it's just, it's so typical, right? As this stuff, you know, starts getting out, when there's actual physical trace evidence that's left over by this stuff, it always seems to be hidden. I don't know how they get to people. I don't know if it's Men in Black. I don't know if it's threats. I don't understand what it is. But it's a big story for a family to go through. I mean, I get it, right? If someone had possibly maybe seeking attention, there are a lot of, especially you see it today, you know, but there are a lot of attention seekers out there that will say and do almost anything to get attention. But why would you subject your kids to that? And normally a kid is unlikely, I suppose, to, you know, really keep being able to hold the story together, you know. And then why would you then open up like a Radio Shack radio and then pull out a piece of metal and then go and already has what is confirmed to be an unusual combination of metals. And then even if it's from a Swedish, what, you take the time to go and find a Swedish instrument somewhere? Not an easy thing to find.
It doesn't add up.
It doesn't add up. So, and then of course, you know, with this particular story, the family, including, you know, his wife, apparently his ex-wife, their 13-year-old daughter, his other son and third younger child, they've all had, during this time, UFO sightings and apparitions appearing within the house. All of them are having these experiences. So is this family being subjected to some type of experiment, some type of, you know, medical examination combined with some type of psychological thing? I really don't know. It is consistent with the abductee era, though. But what to make of it? It's just, it leaves you with obviously more questions
than
answers.
It's those 4-foot-tall government black ops operatives.
Yeah, but I mean, look, the only thing is that I wouldn't
who are also telepathic.
Well, we have allies, right, though. We are the Australians are strongly linked from a military perspective with the Americans. And it makes me wonder when
that's
some of the
4-foot-tall Americans.
No, I'm talking about from the programs that have been conducted in America, right? So MK Ultra style programs, you know, Montauk style programs, that kind of stuff. If you don't want to do it on your own soil anymore, well, where else would you do it? You'd do it in a location that is extremely remote, sparsely populated for the most part. You know, an area where you can kind of have complete plausible deniability. You do it in Australia. So maybe, I mean, maybe this is, you know, part of a far greater conspiracy that we just don't understand, or it simply just could be something very simple as it being extraterrestrials that just come into people's homes and do this. But I don't know. It feels like there's something else to this. There's something uncomfortable. There's something weird that's going on here. But I did say, right, so as I was digging into more of this Australian stuff, and I am working on something else that I might come back to a little bit later on, because this stuff just keeps on going on. Like, there's two more things I want to mention for you before we get into your great Marquis de Sade stuff, Ben. Still in Western Australia, only a year later, right? So it's 1993, and it's very early in 1993. It's January. You have the story of Tony. Now, Tony has had, to his recollection, no memories of alien abduction encounters. He hadn't seen UFOs. He hadn't done anything like that. The guy wasn't even interested in the topic. He wakes up at 3 a.m. to find someone kneeling to the left side of his bed. And he's like, what the hell? Like, you wake up and he's kind of looking. And he says, it's this extremely thin, no head, no normal features except for the ears, faint outline of a thing just next to his bed. And he notices this gold box-like object that's attached to the being's neck just below its right ear. Now, he's in shock. He goes to reach out to touch this thing and his hand goes through it.
Why?
Like, his hand goes... Because, I don't know. I mean,
why would you touch it? Gross.
Well, you'd be like, what the hell are you? And you'd jump up on it. But he reaches through and his hand actually goes through it. And as his hand goes through it, The thing immediately disappears, but then it reappears seconds later, but beyond the closed fly screen door, like it appears on the other side. Now, the dog at the end of the bed was watching the entire incident, but it wasn't doing anything. It didn't move, it didn't growl, it didn't bark. There was no noted anomalies of smell or sound, anything like that. But what he did notice through the screen door is that this being was wearing a grey-green T-shirt with a high neck, like a weird like polo style kind of thing with it, the collar turned up. He said there was also a belt that was supporting loose fitting trousers like pantaloons worn by pirates, but it was too dark to define the feet or any footwear. Right
now, he said it's a gray wearing streetwear.
It's a gray dressed as a pirate. And he wakes up in the morning thinking, oh, geez, that was a weird dream, until he finds a 5 centimeter long rash with soreness on the inside of his left wrist. And he was actually now quite frightened by this nocturnal encounter. And he found that he had trouble sleeping for quite some time. And the reason why he started having trouble sleeping, right, is because after this particular event, the other memories started coming back. The other feelings, the other things started coming back. And he actually recounts seeing a UFO over a lake in 1970 or 1971, it was around midnight. It was this yellow-green flashing light object that slowly moved over the lake as he watched, and then darted away into the clouds and shot off at tremendous speed. You know, like nothing that is that overwhelming when it comes to stories about UFOs, but it sets the scene that this guy was a target. Because then, right, so he saw this UFO in 1970, 1971, he has a memory from 1975 that just comes flying back, this just horrifying memory. Guess what? He's in hospital for no particular reason associated with this. It's just he wakes up at 3 a.m., once again, the same time, to find an unusually dressed nurse kneeling beside the bed doing something with his wrist. This is 1975. He's like, what the hell are you doing? She explains that she is a health visitor doing her rounds at night.
Mm-hmm.
The following morning, he asked the other doctors and nurses and hospital administration who the hell this nurse was, and they said there are no nurses that do rounds at night like this, and there was no nurse fitting that description, and the term health visitor is something that we don't use. So this guy...
So is this another black ops...
I don't know what
government conspiracy?
Well, the implication for me is that the fact that, you know, he has a sighting in 1970, 1975, something shows up and puts something in his wrist because it's in his wrist. It stays in his wrist until 1993 where it's recovered. So I'm like, well, they monitoring something for all those years?
Yeah, monitoring their investment.
Is that what it was? I don't know what this kind of stuff is. So then, of course, you know, it brings me to something that's a little bit different. And I just anecdotally came across this story of Sam, Aboriginal guide Sam. And we go all the way back to Batemans Bay, which is around the other area that I was talking to you about before. And Ben, Batemans Bay, you know, as you know, is associated with a whole heap of UFO activity, apparent Bigfoot encounters, strange...
Bigfoot encounters in Batemans Bay?
Yeah, there's apparently Bigfoots that are hanging around Batemans Bay.
Really? You know,
these weird, hairy,
ape-like...
Not in the surf. Like, it's rugged country.
It's a bay.
Through there.
It's called Batemans Bay.
Yeah, but that whole region of Batemans Bay is very rugged, very dense bushland, sparsely populated.
Maybe it was on a paddleboard.
But a whole heap of high strangers is associated with that area. But there's this story out there of this young man who was at a school camp to the south of Batemans Bay. And when he was at the school camp, and it's a very typical kind of thing to do in Australia, where you go on a school camp, some of the times they'll have Aboriginal guides that will be part of the camp, and they will tell you, you know, dreamtime stories and about Aboriginal culture and that kind of stuff. And on this particular camp, which happened back in the late 80s or so, he claims that there was this guide there by the name of Sam. And Sam was telling him all these stories and kind of like almost ghost stories. He was telling them about Aboriginal culture, but he'd also said, hey, do you want me to tell you about some of the weird stuff that we describe? And of course, you know, these kids are like, yeah, I mean, we're talking 15, 16-year-olds. And they say, yeah, we'd love to hear it. So he starts telling all these stories about the Aboriginal legends of weird encounters and entities and, you know, UFOs, all that kind of stuff. And one of the kids, like in a smirking kind of smart-ass fashion, as kids do, says, oh, what about werewolves? Have you got werewolves? And this guy, Aboriginal guide Sam, kind of looks and it's like, well, we didn't. until the European settlers came here. Yeah, pretty much. And they're all like, what are you talking about? And he goes on to describe this story of where they brought with them artifacts, and these artifacts brought the curse of the werewolf with them. And I'm like, well, that sounds absurd. No, that just sounds ridiculous. But when you look at stories about werewolves, there's stories like the Hexham Heads. And with the Hexham Heads, you know, the crux of that story is, and I'll link to that one as well, is that the these kids find a couple of stone-carved, wolf-like shaped stones, or so I shouldn't say, carved stone, you know, wolf-like heads in their backyard. And they start having weird encounters in their house. Now, they go and give it to these stones to a researcher. This researcher then later on has a wolfman, a spectral wolfman, moving through her house. So the idea is that these stones somehow carried the energy of this wolf. And this guy, Sam, is like, yeah, we've got them here. Now, all the kids go to bed that evening. And the particular, you know, main witness to this story, which is out there, claims that he then wakes up that evening with his mates, and they wake up because they hear like a noise outside, scratching on the outside of their cabin. And it's this wooden cabin, and they get up to the window and they're all shocked because there's this face up against the glass, and this face is red-eyed, like soft glowing red embers. It's like dull glowing red embers and thick black fur, and there's a malevolence to it, but it grins. And like you said with that other story, Ben, of the werewolf, it like it grinned at them, but they also got this feeling of just evilness and malevolence that was coming through with this. And they were so obviously terrified that they start screaming. And when they start screaming, they see lights in the distance coming over this hill, and it's the, you know, the teachers that are coming over to hear like this ruckus. And this thing they watch as this thing drops to all fours and bounds off and disappears. And the crux of this story is that as much as they were, you know, freaked out by this, the following day, Sam, the Aboriginal guide, comes back and is like, how was your night last night? And the kids are like, and they're kind of sheepish and like, oh, we just didn't sleep very well. And it's like, yeah, that's because the werewolves were around, weren't they? And of course, the kids are all freaked out. And the idea here is that Sam himself had somehow taken on the form of this werewolf to scare these kids because they'd been smart asses about it. But there's a few of those iterations.
So which is it? Is it the werewolves came over with artifacts, or is it an Aboriginal shapeshifter?
No, that they took. The idea was with this story is that the Aboriginals didn't know how to shapeshift. There are stories with like, what's the book called? I think it's Aboriginal Men of High Degree. There are stories of shapeshifters in Aboriginal culture. But this particular one, the implication is that they couldn't shapeshift into werewolves until these artifacts came over. Or this curse came over. And when it did, then it's almost like it transferred this ability of being able to shapeshift into these werewolves. So, you know, look, take it with a grain of salt, that story. It's just kind of a throwaway story, but I thought it fascinating nonetheless. But of course, I'll link
to
it.
No Aboriginal guides are that interesting in my experience. They just yabber on about their ancestors for an hour.
No, it's very boring. No, some
and then
heard
finally they let you throw their boomerang, and it's nothing like the cartoons. It doesn't come back. Boomerangs are a lie, dude. They don't come back. They just curve.
Yeah, it's part of big boomerang.
They curve a little bit and then hit the dirt.
Because you're not throwing it properly.
You throw it 100 times. You have all the kids in my school throwing boomerangs all day. Not a single one comes back. And then we get the Aboriginal guide to throw it. Does the same thing. Straight into the dirt. It's bullshit.
Okay, now you mentioned it. I must say, I have never seen a boomerang come
boomerangs
back.
Are a lie. And Aboriginal guides are boring. You heard it here first.
I disagree. I think there's some really incredible stories that you hear from that kind of stuff. And I'm particularly fascinated with it. And actually, it reminded me of something that you'd said a while ago, because I was reading more about the Wangina, which are those depictions of those, I don't know, some people say they're aliens, others say that they're sky gods, this kind of thing. But I didn't know, but some tribes describe with the Wangina, the reason why they're painted without mouths, like they're never painted with mouths, is because if they were to speak, the knowledge that they would bring would be overwhelming. And it's like what we've heard before. Remember how we're talking about the different levels of gods? And there's like the gods have to basically use minions to get through to humans,
right?
Because we can't connect with them directly because it would be too overwhelming for us. So it's the same kind of story that comes up in these traditional legends as well. So, you know, take from it what you will. But I'll link to all of this stuff in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can check it out and read more about it.
Maybe the Aboriginal guide was part of some secret government black ops project.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And the children were part of some CIA MK Ultra program running in Australian school camps.
No, there's no connection at all. It's just a throwaway story that I wanted to add in. But going back to the other stories, yes, I wouldn't be surprised if there's something going on there.
Well, let's move on to something a little bit different. We've got The Curse of the Marquis de Sade by Joel Warner, and he sets the scene October the 22nd, 1785. And this is in the Tower of Bastille, where there's a solitary convict locked in his cell, and he starts to write. And he writes, "The extensive wars that Louis XIV had to wage throughout the course of his reign, while exhausting the state's finances and the people's resources, nevertheless uncovered the secret to enriching an enormous number of those leeches, always lying in wait for the public calamities they provoke, rather than quell in order to profit from them all the more. It was towards the end of this reign that four among them conceived the unique feat of debauchery we are about to describe. This prisoner then watched as his quill started to fill the page with delicate, almost microscopically small letters." And here, Warner describes likely what his cell would have been like. Like the, you know, would have
horrible
reeked of sewerage because there's a pipe running his under his window that goes into the moat below. And he listens out and there's, you know, screams of torture and clattering keys and bolts slamming into place. And around the shelves, he would have had shelves in his cell that demonstrated that this prisoner was no ordinary prisoner. There would be shelves sagging with 600 books, you know, famous books by Homer, Newton, Shakespeare, books on the existence of God and the motion of fluids. There would have been expensive bottles of cologne, fine linen towels, velvet cushions, you know, nice rugs. Nothing like your regular prisoner, even though this is the Bastille, with the prison with the worst reputation.
Is that because he's aristocracy?
Yeah, he's aristocracy. And there was also a prized collection of dildos fashioned from rosewood and ebony, crafted to exact specifications by a prominent Parisian cabinet maker.
What specifications could there possibly be?
Exact ones. The cell's occupant was one of the most notorious criminals in 18th century France. He had spent the bulk of his 45 years reveling in depravity. Blasphemous acts with prostitutes, torturing beggars, poisoning whores, hiding in Italy in the romantic company of his sister-in-law, locking away girls and boys in his chateau for his own sexual designs, and narrowly surviving a bullet fired at his chest. For years, this man had evaded the law, breaking out of an Alpine prison, dodging a military raid on his home, escaping from the clutches of a police squadron, and eluding his own public execution. His name, of course, was Donatien Alphonse François de Sade, but most people knew him as the Marquis de Sade. So it's quite an introduction. This guy obviously lived an incredibly interesting life.
Is that why he was imprisoned, though, because of the depravity?
Yeah, I mean, he actually did commit a lot of crimes, like the depravity was often not consensual. With the person. Often he, say it would be a prostitute, he would pay the prostitute to do certain things, but then those things would get more and more extreme as the night went on, and that person wouldn't be allowed to leave. And there's actually some police reports of these prostitutes that escaped and went and reported what he did. But he was captured in 1778, he was imprisoned at a royal residence that was converted into a prison. But then in 1784, that was shut down, and that's when he was moved to the infamous Bastille, the most notorious prison in all of Europe, you could say. And he'd essentially been locked up by the king, by order of the king. That's how notorious this guy was. The king had to step in and go, okay, no, we're done with this guy.
Who was this? Was this Louis the 16th?
Louis the... He has a 16th, yes, 14th?
Maybe 14th, one of those.
I don't know my French kings. But anyway, there's no trial. So the point is there's no imprisonment term. He's just locked up and the key is literally thrown away, I guess.
So basically at the king's behest.
Yes. So he still was treated quite well. As I mentioned, he had all the trappings of aristocracy imported into the prison. And that was the thing back then. Like, you were considered above the regular people, you know. Yeah. And even as a criminal, you were treated differently. So, for example, his wife kept on sending him his favorite food. So he's in this horrible prison. He's getting eel pate, chocolate cakes, bacon-wrapped delicious things to eat every day.
Stop so fancies.
He was obese as well. He was just getting massively obese in this prison. So he started to be plagued by migraines, gout, nosebleeds. He had breathing problems, dizzy spells. His hemorrhoids were so bad, he had to order a special leather cushion so
like
he
could pillow.
Still sit at his desk and write his things. His eyesight was nearly ruined, and he started to wear these strange mask-like leather goggles.
Mm.
So picture this guy, like, surrounded by opulence and large wooden dildos, massively obese and wearing these ridiculous goggles. And in his mounting delusion in the Bastille, he started to notice a secret code. He started to believe that there were numerical signs that were sent his way to give him clues about when he would be released, who was conspiring against him. And these numerical signs included the number of days he'd been imprisoned, the number of letters and packages he received. There was some kind of code to it all. And this was also calculated by the amount of times he masturbated in his cell each day. Like, that was the variable.
He has control over that. So there's no code here.
No, but there were outside forces forcing him to wank in his cell. And that was the Da Vinci code he was trying to crack. But at other times, he was just like, yeah, I'm going mad. He actually realized he was going crazy.
Did he have syphilis? He's likely to have syphilis.
Probably had it at some stage. But Saad developed one obsession that eclipsed all others in this prison, and that was the desire to write. So he wrote that, "My muse, it sweeps me along, forces me to write, despite myself. And no matter what people may do to try to stop me, there is no way they will ever succeed." Isn't that interesting? He spoke about his muse. There was some force that drove him to write what ultimately became a very depraved, evil document. He composed endless letters, essays, plays, and novellas. But ultimately, his work resulted in something so violent and so obscene, he would often be described as the freest spirit who ever lived, which is demonstrating that he had no restraints at all, no moral restraints. Thanks to his writing, Saad would be so deeply associated with cruelty and perversion that, as we know, his name became synonymous with deriving pleasure from pain. So nothing could match the vulgarity of the effort he began that October evening. Experts would come to call this the gospel of evil. And this was the scroll that became 120 days of Sodom. Do you know anything about the story?
Because I have no understanding of 120 days of Sodom.
Yeah. I mean, I know 99 days of Sodom, but not the 120 of
it. Oh, I can get to 110 on a good run. But, like, that's it.
On a good run. It's really shocking. I didn't know. I just knew that it was considered smutty, like that it was considered, you know, what's the shades of grey, whatever.
That's, 50 shades of grey.
It was considered like 50 shades of grey.
But French style.
In the 18th century. But that's putting it mildly, to say the least.
Does it involve a lot of wooden precise dildos?
No, it's really bad. It's the story of four wealthy degenerates. There's a duke, a bishop, a judge, and a financier. And they engage in a four-month orgy for which they gather 32 subordinates. There's their four young wives, eight virile men, four elderly female prostitutes, and as the prime targets of their crimes, 16 boys and girls aged 12 to 15, selected from a group of several hundred children kidnapped from their homes.
In the telling, the four nobles and their retinue retreat to a mountaintop chateau in the depths of central Europe, heavily fortified, this citadel called Silling Castle. And this is basically a giant prison. There's walled-up exit gates. There's impossible chasms that you can't get past. There's snow drifts. There's no hope of escape. It's like Alcatraz. And as the Duke, the most, I guess, evil, domineering of the four, he tells several of the prisoners, "You are already dead to the world, and it is only for our pleasures that you are breathing now." And this castle, he goes on to describe these furnished apartments, soundproofed compartments, torture chambers buried deep in the earth. And these four noblemen subject their victims to 120 days of escalating depravity. And the first day involves one of the old prostitutes in the story recounting a story that has priests and pedophilia, bodily fluids. And this is the tamest of all the stories.
Jesus, that's saying something.
So it is really shockingly depraved and evil. And it gets worse and worse day after day. The perversions that he writes about escalate. It becomes starker and starker, and the narrative kind of falls away, and eventually it's just horror after horror, incest, bestiality, coprophilia, necrophilia, starvation. Then there's
forgive me, but what's coprophilia?
I don't know, but it sounds bad.
Yeah, okay.
I'm scared to Google.
Don't Google that. Yeah, you'll get your door kicked.
Disemboweling, amputation, there's castration, there's cannibalism, and eventually there's infanticide.
Oh.
And by the end of the novel, this castle is awash in blood, in body parts, in the dead bodies,
how
dead babies.
Like truly horrendously dreadful.
And that's just me giving a very brief nutshell
description.
Is it described
in his book, is it?
No, he does the same thing. Yeah. He does a very general wrap-up. And the question is, like, that I was asking, what's behind this story? Because people that read it or translated it centuries later would detect almost a specter lurking between the words. So the very act of reading the story from end to end, points out Warner, it seems to exact a physical toll on the individual.
Mm.
So in 1957, there was the French philosopher Georges Bataille, who declared, "Nobody, unless he is totally deaf to it, can finish 120 days of Sodom without feeling sick." The Sard publisher Jean-Jacques Pauvert admitted that his and his colleagues' work on the novel, quote, "made us profoundly uneasy for several weeks. The atmosphere broken by outbursts of the unexpected, truly crazed laughter." So you would lose your mind reading this. Austin Wainhouse, the American author who first translated the book into English in the 1960s, wrote that, quote, "Sometimes it happens that reading becomes something else, something excessive and grave. It sometimes happens that a book reads its readers through." All of this suggests agency of the actual text itself. It has some kind of mind. It has some kind of spirit to it. And most recently, there's the British professor, Will McMorran. He started work on an updated English translation. He wrote on his blog that, quote, "Translating felt like a struggle for agency. Sometimes it felt like I was acting on the text. Sometimes it felt like the text was acting on me." And McMorran would come away from the experience believing that this text, 120 Days of Sodom, was the worst thing ever written. Now, there is a mystery behind this scroll because, you know, its very existence is a mystery. Like, why would someone have written something so appalling?
Well, he's just a deviant, isn't he? Like, does he want to spread his depravity to others?
He is a deviant, but there's something else to it. And also the timing of this, it's right on the cusp of the French Revolution. Like, everything is brewing. The hatred for the rich, the hatred for the aristocracy, the desire for blood and vengeance. It's this energy of hate. And it's almost, you could imagine, it's bubbling up but it would have been in the air. It would have felt thick with this seething hatred and this feeling of injustice. And some people have speculated that it's almost like he channeled something or some spirit in the air. And when you look at the text, like, it's absolutely huge. It's massive, and he would have had to have written it in secret, and he wrote so small that you need a magnifying glass to actually read it. It's like microscopic text.
Well, that's the thing. How would you write that? Because I'm assuming that you'd use a quill or something. Surely you can't make a microtext.
He had a quill, but yeah, he just developed this technique where he could do this little microscopic writing. Like, the guy who writes
is that, did he or did something else through him?
Well, then, yeah, he says that something is using him. So Sa'd was a revolutionary. He was a bit of a radical philosopher.
Yeah, because he wants everyone else to be as deviant as he is.
But there's the question of, was he these things, or was he just a criminal who was chronicling his own atrocities? Like, were these just things that he had done in his life and he just wanted to write it down?
Yeah, maybe.
And then there's all this weirdness of the document itself. Like I pointed out, it's tiny, tiny text, and he would work on it in the evening, you know, well into the night, because he wouldn't be caught. It would be too scandalous to get caught with this stuff. And it's just one sheet of paper that he would basically, when he would get to the end of it, he would paste another piece to connect it. So ultimately, it ends up
one scroll
with this huge scroll covered in words. There's 157,000 words on this thing. And in the years to come, Warner writes, this scroll would embark on a century-spanning odyssey that would take it across Europe. It would endure revolutions, world wars. It would land in the epicenter of scientific, artistic, and literary upheavals and become the focus of an audacious heist and international court battles. The fragile text would move from one owner to the next and manage to outlast them all. And finally, in 2014, one of the most powerful men in France would purchase 120 Days of Sodom for 7 million euros. The price made it among the most valuable manuscripts in the world, comparable to original copies of the Gutenberg Bible and the Canterbury Tales. The scroll settled into its new home just in time for a year-long national celebration of the bicentennial of Sa'd's death. And essentially, he had been re-evaluated by French, I guess, historians, who would declare that he's kind of France's Shakespeare. And it really shows how far culture has fallen, where, you know, he was terrified to write this when he did, because if anyone found it, it would be the greatest crime, you know, ever conceived, to write such horrible, evil things on a page. But now, you skip ahead a few hundred years, he's celebrated as a genius. He's some kind of liberated spirit who should be, all his work should be returned to France as some kind of treasure, you know, kept in the most secure vaults. And these private collectors are paying huge fortunes for this.
But is it just because of the historical value? Because if it's the contents, there's something seriously wrong with the collector.
Well, we'll get into some of that, because he details the collectors over time. And one of them we know very well. One of them, it's
Crowley, isn't it?
It's connected to someone we know very well. So, within a few months,
whenever there's a wooden dildo involved.
Within a few months of it eventually coming back to this Frenchman who bought it for 7 million euros, the French authorities descended on his business empire and basically crushed him. And to this day, he's still waiting on the trial, but his business was destroyed, something that he spent decades building up. And the timing, you can't help but notice, as soon as he came into the possession of this manuscript, of this scroll, he was destroyed by the state. Now, some would conclude that, it wasn't a coincidence that he got this and then lost everything. So there's also this weird mystery associated with the storming of the Bastille. So this was July 14th, 1789. He'd actually written it 4 years earlier and hidden it in his cell. And the city at the time, if you understand, you know, the French history around this time,
It wasn't good. Like, it was...
It would have been a mess.
Massive, I think there was massive deflation at the time, or the price of bread had inflated massively, and bread's what most people ate as the main part of their diets. It was just costing so much money. Like, you'd spend most of your income on food.
Well, that's where the rumor of let them eat cake comes from, because right. the price of bread became so high, it was unobtainable to the peasants. So Marie Antoinette yelled out, "Let them eat cake!"
Right, right.
And I don't know how true that is, though.
There was poor harvests on top of that. And yeah, King Louis XVI, you're right. Ultimately, his leadership led to this financial crisis. There were really desperate measures to try and boost the income for the aristocracy as well. Like, they had new walls around Paris where they had a toll. Like, if you wanted to come into the city, you had to pay a toll now. They made a trade agreement with Britain. So essentially...
Were they at war with Britain?
Not at this stage, I don't think, because...
There's a lull in hostilities.
This is why I love this period of history, because you just see the parallels with today.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yes.
France is flooded with all these cheap British goods, just like the West is flooded with cheap goods from China.
Yeah.
And immediately people lose their jobs, you know, French industry fails, everything is just cheap stuff from overseas. And eventually it gets to the point where the nation is plunged further into debt. And the only way out of this is all these Parisians go on government assistance.
I think part of the problem at the time was, I believe, weren't the French going to fight in America against the British as well? I think that's what, and so much resources was being given to French forces that, again, it's like today, all this money was going to a foreign country to fight a war that we had nothing to do with, or that the French had nothing to do with.
Yeah. And at the same time, there were all these radical philosophical movements championing egalitarianism and a lot of jockeying for political power. And so the final provocation, as many of you know, was an attempt from the king to raise revenues. And there was some assembly to essentially... make some political changes, but there was an argument over who would have the most power. And this kind of set everyone off. I won't go into the details, but basically a mob of citizens, you know, raided the army barracks, grabbed all the weapons they could, and were ready for blood. But they didn't have ammunition. They had all these rifles and whatever they used back then, but they didn't have any ammunition. So
muskets.
They learnt that there were hundreds of barrels of gunpowder being stored in the Bastille. So that's why they raided the prison
to get the
ammunition. So that afternoon, hundreds of these people took up their knives and muskets and stormed it. And essentially, this is an attack on their kingdom, an attack on their king. Now, the warden and his men, they gave a bit of a fight, but they basically tried to negotiate with the mob and said, let us leave with our lives and you can have everything. And the mob escorted them to the town square and then
killed
the warden.
Yeah.
Killed his men, put their heads on spikes. And back at the prison, the revolutionaries, they went in, they ransacked the place, they got the gunpowder, they threw open the cells. There were only 7 prisoners in there. There was some convicted forgers. There was someone who was an assassin, or part of a royal assassination plot. And they ascended the stairs to this double doors, and there's this very opulent cell. And they find this small room filled with all these luxuries and papers and letters and very elaborate carved wooden dildos carved to very precise specifications.
Diamond studded.
But the cell's empty. The occupant is nowhere to be found. And the cell had obviously been recently inhabited because there was no dust or anything in there. And there were signs that they were just there. Like, you know, there was a meal that had recently been eaten.
So what, he fled?
There was no indications of a planned departure. There was no indications of an escape. Nothing in the cell had been organized or disturbed for a move or anything. Everything was all scattered out like he was just there. Even the clothing remained undisturbed. But the Marquis de Sade was gone. And Warner writes, it was as if he had vanished into thin air. He was just gone. Now, from here, this is where Warner splits into these 3 stories, like the custody of the document, how it was found, and then this French conspiracy. But started continuing with this story because of that mystery of him vanishing from the prison. Like, what was behind this? Is there some kind of supernatural side to this? Did he make a deal with the devil? Is that how he escaped?
Yeah, like, what could he possibly have done? I mean, it would stand to reason that he maybe had sympathizers and they got him out.
I think he just blew one of the guards.
And you could keep my second finest dildo.
I think something like that. So eventually the Bastille was dismantled and they used it for, you know, for other projects in the city. But there was a man named Arnaud who eventually found the scroll. He found it hidden in the wall of the Bastille in the cell. Now, no one knows for sure how he did this. We just know that he came into possession of it. It's likely that he was responsible for dismantling the cell. He was probably a laborer. Now, he didn't hand it in because everything that was found needed to be handed in to the new government. But he cleverly hung on to it because he knew he would get a lot of money for it if he sold it to a private collector. And he ended up moving back home. He moved out of Paris and sold it to someone that lived near his hometown. It was this mayor of the home village he was from. His name was Charles André de Beaumont. He sold it to him he was the mayor in 1876, but he would have sold it to him in the late 1790s, I think. And this guy was one of these bibliophiles. He had this collection of rare books. He had the Beaumont Library. But we don't know what he made of the manuscript because he never wrote about it. We just know that he had it. He never shared it with anyone. Maybe he never even read it, maybe because it was too small.
I was just wondering that.
Maybe he just kept it away. Anyway, as the years went on, the years stretched into decades and there was upheaval in the world. The revolution gave way to Napoleon. Then there was decades of mayhem and war. France swung back and forth between empire, monarchy, and republic. And all the while, this scroll, 120 Days of Sodom, remained in Beaumont's possession until the day the collection passed to his son-in-law, Raymond de Villeneuve. Now, the scroll travelled east, pasting fields and dusty hilltop villages, and likely came to rest in the Chateau Library. This was where he kept his family records, he kept his mementos. And this guy, Raymond de Villeneuve, he was one of the last of the French aristocracy. Like, they lost their power, they were slipping into obsolescence. And there it would have remained, mouldering away, if not for his son, Helion de Villeneuve, born in 1827. This guy was a bit of a progressive. Like, he actually supported the revolution. He wanted this radical socialist movement to sweep through Europe. He rallied behind the socialist Paris Commune.
It's just history repeating itself, isn't it?
And he was also a bibliophile. Like, he was obsessed with this family library. And this is where Warner points out that France was full of these bibliophiles. And it's something that you can't quite appreciate in the modern age. I think, you know, some of us, we collect lots of books, but there's something about the French love of documents and the written word that Warner points out exceeds all other cultures. Like, they're just obsessed with books, collecting them, understanding them.
So already, you know, when we're talking about there being, you know, something supernatural occurring here, because already culturally they've got this love and appreciation of books, you've already got that kind of energy going into it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing about this this descendant who eventually took on the title the Marquis de Villeneuve Trans, this guy being the bibliophile, he had a very specific obsession amongst this bibliophile obsession.
What, the dirty text?
Yeah, he was obsessed with the world of erotic books.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they kind of, Warner explains that collectors in the world, like bibliophiles, they're always on the hunt for rare artifacts, right? That's part of the appeal.
Yeah,
it's finding, you know, the first edition with a particular cover that's signed by the author. But The search for erotic books was almost like a hunter on safari trying to find a unicorn. Because they were illegal and they're often destroyed and always kept secret, when you found one, yeah, it was like the ultimate treasure. And so there were these underground writings of Marquis de Sade, not this scroll, but his other writings that were circulating, and they were really sought after by these bibliophiles. So they were also associated with all these Jacobins and socialists as well. So some claim that Sade's novel Justine, one of his other kind of dirty works, served as the black scripture of the French Revolution. And Robespierre, the architect of the Reign of Terror, apparently turned to Sade's writing, quote, whenever he found that his bloodlust needed fortifying. So this takes us back to the idea of a spirit being behind this, some kind of energy, a specter in between the words, because you've got the architects of this bloody period of history.
Well, there's that bloodlust there as well that comes up in so many of these kinds of stories of possession and curses.
And when they feel down and when they question, oh, maybe should I really be doing this? You know, should I really kill all these people? Do they really deserve it? He opens up one of Sade's texts and immediately that spirit is giving him that energy again.
Mm.
No, we need to kill the king. We need to chop off all their heads and, you know, terrorize the aristocracy.
It's gruesome stuff.
So the distinguished French poet Charles Baudelaire noted in his journal that to understand evil, one must always return to de Sade. So this was the understanding. Like, there was some power in his work. And as you go through the story, it's every kind of, you know, socialist, communist, extremist you can think of that's somehow inspired by this work, connected, seeking it out in some way.
Isn't it fascinating as well, this degeneracy which is attached to this lack of respect for life and this bloodlust? And like, it always seems to follow the same. It's almost like these concepts, the entity behind it, you know, it's like it can't function unless it's dark.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be blood. It has to be
misery and
blood and killing, yes, and evil and
overthrowing and taking away people's hard work and
depravity and everything else. So this Villeneuve, again, he's a young extreme socialist who wants to overthrow the government. He becomes enamored with Sade's work.
Of course he does.
And he works closely with Jules Adolphe Chauvet, who's the era's most prominent erotica illustrator, and he commissions him to do all these dirty pictures to go with it. And he essentially, he's famous for fashioning a wooden capsule to hold 120 days of Sodom. So he makes a phallic-shaped wooden box with like a secret compartment where the scroll is stored. And he lives the decadent life of a bachelor. His father dies in 1857 and he's left with the entire family's wealth. But because he lived much like de Sade lived.
So he's just smoking crack and getting foot jobs all the time.
Yeah, he's basically living like a degenerate. It was only 8 or 9 years later, he had to sell his family's chateau, which had been in the family since 1201.
So he wasted it all.
Can you imagine having something in your family for 600 years?
No, I can't. But to these people, I don't think they care. Like, if you're that far gone.
Imagine your family's property is 600 years old.
And you lose it.
And you just want to smoke crack all day and you have to sell it to buy more crack.
Yeah.
That's the equivalent.
That's what it is, yeah.
So by 1878, his troubles had grown so dire, he auctioned off his library and he sold 120 days of Sodom. And, well, he really needed to find a potential buyer. Now, where do you go in the late 1800s when you want to sell the most sought-after smut in the world?
Vatican City.
Queen Victoria's England.
Oh.
It was one of the biggest erotica markets in Europe at the time, which is kind of weird because you look at the Victorian era.
Very stuffy and...
Yeah, like...
I think it's to be an undercurrent.
Warner points out that it was believed that
if especially men, like men needed their vitality to maintain the British Empire. And if they became obsessed with sex, if the British people gave in to lust and desires, it would sap, literally sap the people of the energy that kept the British Empire going.
Have you seen the British Empire today?
Yeah, it didn't work out. Women were counseled to present themselves as beacons of chastity, even when they were married. So the female body was hidden with corsets and petticoats and all that. Even piano legs. Like, that's why they have...
The French ones are all sexy, but the British ones weren't?
No, well, that's why they have covers. Like, if you think of... I remember this from my grandmother's house in England when I was, like, 6 years old, where the piano would have these, like, the legs would have these little covers on them.
Like stockings?
Yeah. And it's because the piano leg was a suggestive shaping.
What? Are you saying that people have got such blue balls in that time that even the subtle sexiness of a piano leg could cause you to have a pants eruption?
Like, I don't think... it's anyone actually getting aroused by a wooden piano leg, but it's become so embedded in the culture that anything that's shaped or curved a certain way should generally be covered up.
Right.
Right. So even the language has this. So instead of breasts, they start saying bosom. And instead of sexual organs, you say the unmentionables.
Put away those bosoms, madam.
Yeah, and then pornographic writing is now referred to as top shelf, out of the way, facetious texts, curious texts. So despite all this, it's almost like when you go to the extreme with something, it bubbles back in another way.
Of course, yeah.
19th century London had this flourishing sex industry. It had totally taken root. And we've spoken about some of this on previous episodes of the show. There was the cock and hen clubs. There was the unofficial street woman promenades.
Oh, yes. Mm.
Same-sex bordellos, private drag shows, flagellation salons, all that sort of stuff was going on. And in the middle of it all, there was the infamous Holywell Street. So Holywell Street was this little crooked lane that it's basically, like, you know how you go to Akihabara in Tokyo and you go to the 11th floor and it's just the most disgusting filth you've ever seen?
Yep.
This was the entire street, was the 11th floor in Tokyo. Just disgusting pornography.
I don't know why, but for some reason, in Japan, it's like almost like it's okay. Like, that's Japan. But if you think about it in Britain, you're just like, ugh.
Yeah, so they have, these shops would have volumes like The Adventures of a Bedstead, The Stories of Dil Do, and my personal favorite, Raped on a Railway. That was one of the best sellers. And they also had a bunch of copies of the 18th century classic Fanny Hill. That's also a good one. Raped on a Railway is way better, though. And then Fred Hankey was essentially at the center of all this. And I'm sure we've done segments on Hankey. He was born to a well-placed English diplomat in 1821, settled in a posh neighborhood of Paris in a young age, and essentially he started to track down erotica. Like, it was his favorite thing to try and collect this erotica. He would smuggle it across the English Channel. He had people like hide it in their pants, or he would like
smuggle erotica.
Yeah, like smuggling drugs. He would have carriages, or, you know, put them under the carriages, and like cocaine, he would make secret compartments to smuggle erotica. But he wasn't just a middleman. He was like a collector as well, a connoisseur of this debauchery. And essentially, because of this reputation, Chauvet, who now had the manuscript, approached him in 1875 and tried to sell it to him for 5,000 francs, which is more than you would earn in a year back then, way more. And he turned it down. And part of the reason why he turned it down is because for him, it was more about the aesthetics of what he was collecting rather than the content. That's what people say.
Sounds like an excuse to me.
It's like he wanted the nice, like, gold gilded hardcover. But if you think De Sade's scroll was just this filthy thing that's been sitting in a prison.
It's been glued together.
And it's in this gross dildo box. He didn't really want it. So then he turns to Henry Spencer Ashby. And Ashby had this really distinguished collection of literature.
He was born to a gunpowder mill manager in 1834, but married into this German mercantile family and took over the family business, was really, really rich. And he established a company office in France. And while he was in France, he discovered erotic literature. And it soon became his number one passion. Like, he was completely obsessed with it, to the point where he had basically paid for an entire apartment in London that no one knew about, where he would just fill it with his personal library. And word got
all smut.
Totally of erotic literature, and word got around. So Chauvet tried to sell him the document in April the 22nd of 1875, and he turned it down as well. At the time, he claimed he was spending all his money and effort on creating a bibliography of erotic literature. He wanted to create the encyclopedia of erotic literature. That was his main life's goal at the time. And he eventually released this in 1877, which we have mentioned on the show. It's called the Index Librorum Prohibitorum, which is like a Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Harry Potter spell.
Of filth.
Turns you trans. Index Librorum Prohibitorum. And Villeneuve Trans is basically screwed now. He doesn't know who to sell it to. There's indications that he's going to lose everything. He really needs to sell this manuscript. And the connection to Crowley here is because this book came out in the 1880s called My Secret Life. I'll link to it in the show notes. And it was by an anonymous author. And this was a 4,200-page, 11-volume work, right? And it was just absolute dirty smut, right? Just disgusting, erotic smut. And apparently it was the prized possession of Aleister Crowley. He loved these 11 volumes. He would read it all the time, take it with him everywhere.
And it about stealing women's clothing from airports or something?
Well, it detailed the life of this Victorian gentleman who went by the name Walter. And it was just him, like, traveling the world, sleeping with prostitutes, courtesans, and just getting up to general debauchery all over the world. And scholars have long surmised that it was actually Ashby, this guy who had this collection in London, who wrote the book. And it's real; it's like his life story.
It's either that, or he's read so much of the smut that he's created this narrative.
Yeah. And like all these guys, like, they ultimately end up alone and penniless. Like, Ashby's wife and his two of his three children abandon him. He never spoke to his family again. He died and left his entire collection to the British Museum, including all the erotica, and it's kind of locked away, and you can only see it with special permission. So these two collectors, Ashby and Hankey, if they had gotten it, it would have been in the British Museum today, the scroll.
Probably a good thing that it's not, by the sounds of it.
But the scroll never made it to England. The scroll remained unsold. And when Villeneuve Trans passed away in 1893, he didn't marry, he didn't have an heir. It went to his extended family and made it to a local bookseller, and it resided there awaiting for the right person to claim it. And it just, it's almost like the ring in Lord of the Rings, where, if you know the story, it basically sits there waiting for the right moment, and then it lures an individual to corrupt them.
Mm.
And that's what this scroll did. It sat in this bookshop waiting for the next person to come along and claim it so that the curse could continue. So in the next show on Friday, I'll continue the story of the custody of this scroll and how ultimately it led to the center of the greatest Ponzi scheme in the history of France, perhaps the history of Europe, where a multi-billion dollar company was taken down after the scroll was obtained.
There's a real, I mean, it sounds like a curse attached to this thing.
Yeah, and you'll hear as it goes along, because there's multiple people that end up getting it. They all get ruined in similar ways as soon as they get this scroll. But not before they're able to, I guess, push forward their
political goals and cultural goals.
Yeah, it's almost like making a deal with the devil. It's like you get something that you desire, but you pay an ultimate price for it.
Yeah.
Does it actually reveal? No, I won't ask. I'll wait until that show. I'll wait.
Yeah, it gets pretty complicated because there's this really weird. The way that this French guy created this business is this whole other story, and it just kind of blows my mind. Like, yeah, imagine owning a share in a letter from Einstein.
You could see how
to Heisenberg or something.
Well, you could see how it would work. I mean, I guess in some way you could apply it to any type of historical, you know, artifact. You could see that you would assume that something the older it got from a political figure or a famous figure in history would appreciate in value. So you could see why people are like, yeah, I want to share in that. It makes sense.
Yeah.
But the market probably doesn't work that way. It makes sense, but it probably doesn't work that way.
But when you own something, I don't like this timeshare thing as well. Like when you own something physically.
You want to own
it. I want to have it.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to be able to control it.
Yeah.
I don't want it in a museum or stored in some warehouse somewhere. I want it. I want to have it on the weekends.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I get that.
So that's a wrap for this show. I'll continue that story on the curse of Marquis de Sade on the next show. A notorious scoundrel, a mythical manuscript, and the biggest scandal in literary history. I'll also link to The Erotomaniac if you want to read more about Henry Spencer Ashby and some of those weirdos from the Victorian era with their elaborate
fun thrusting.
Specific wooden dildos. It's all good fun.
Until someone loses an eye.
That's a wrap for this show. Thank you so much for being on Plus. We'll catch you on Friday for the next one. See you then.